In for a Peso, In for a Pound, Chapter 8. The seven men relaxed around the fire after a filling supper of beans, biscuits, and the rabbits Ezra and Josiah had provided. Amid the deep, comfortable feeling of camaraderie, of kinship that welled from them and caught each in its bond, further weaning from isolation men who for so long had lived imprisoned by it. Stories came as naturally as breathing, and voices rose and fell in waves of sound as one after another shared a bit more of his life, or of himself. Josiah spoke of the travels of his youth, his deep, resonant voice weaving a mystical spell of sight, sound, and smell as he described the exotic people and places he had seen. J.D., for whom such lands existed only in books, listened in wide-eyed awe, asking questions, his eager mind absorbing every detail as if his very existence depended upon such knowledge. Ezra, too, proved a naturally gifted storyteller, his lyrical, honeyed drawl painting images of New Orleans, of Charleston and Savannah, of the Mississippi River, and the fabled gambling boats that plied up and down her length. He spoke of the seedy and the spectacular, and brought both to vivid life. Nathan spoke of his youth, his past, not of the brutal toil that had filled his days, or even more brutal punishments that still marked his back, but of the people he had known, and of the stories they had told. He talked of men and women who had been born, lived, and died in bondage, but whose souls had never been chained. And in listening to him, the men around the fire gained a deeper understanding and appreciation of the strength, courage, and dignity they so admired in him. Buck naturally told them of the women he had known, and of his grand and raucous adventures with them, again and again revealing his gift for bringing laughter to men who had known far too much of sorrow. But he also gradually brought Chris into the stories, sharing tales of their years together and getting enough of the details so wrong that Larrabee felt compelled to set the record straight. And soon, with more than one appreciative glance at Buck, the six were listening to their usually taciturn leader sharing stories of his wild, adventurous youth. One voice, though, had remained steadfastly silent, except for an occasional question or the characteristic wry and deflating barb thrown at Buck or Chris. Vin had been content to listen, eyes sometimes closed, soaking in the sounds of his friends' voices, picturing in his mind the images they created, simply breathing them ever more deeply into himself. He gathered the nuggets they shared as if they were jewels, hoarding them against the time when he might have need of such riches to sustain him. He learned early in life that such times as these, such people as these, were rare and fleeting, that they could be lost in the blink of an eye, and that they were gifts not to be taken for granted or forgotten. Memory held a powerful medicine for him, and he who had so little worth remembering crafted each new one as carefully as an artist would a painting. But J.D., filled to the brim with all the earnestness and deep goodwill of youth, could not permit his friend to remain outside the circle. These men mattered to him as no others ever had, as he knew no others ever would. He was past thinking of them as icons, as flawless idols, knew they were each imperfect and broken in 100 different ways. Even so, they had about them a strength, a wisdom, something fierce and free and so wonderful that he still hoped to learn its secret and make it a part of himself, as it was so much a part of them. Even through their cracks and flaws, he saw their better natures and wanted to shape himself in their image. These were true men, a dying breed, and he wanted nothing more than to be counted an equal in their company. So he was not about to let Tanner, who had a knowledge of the earth and those things on it that the boy considered positively mystical, place himself outside that company. From experience, though, he knew that if he waited for Vin to join a conversation willingly, he could wait forever, and he just didn't have that kind of patience. It was one of the lessons from these men he had yet to master. "Hey, Vin," he called when the others had fallen silent, sounding as if he'd been pondering the coming question for some time. "How come you call Peso, Peso?" All eyes turned at once to the tracker, who was clearly startled by the sudden attention. But he was stretched out on his bedroll, propped against his saddle, and too drowsy from a good meal, a cup of willow bark tea, and a dollop of laudanum Nathan had slipped into his coffee to make any escape. and he'd gleaned enough from his friends that he felt obliged to offer them something in return. So without reservation or resentment, he answered simply, "'Cause that's what I paid for him." Five men blinked in astonishment, and J.D. blurted sharply, "'A peso? You only paid a peso for a horse?' Men shrugged lightly. "'For that horse, yeah.' When his friends continued to gape at him, he added, "'I couldn't just let him shoot him.' Ezra took out his flask, took a drink and swallowed, still staring at Tanner. When the tracker appeared in no hurry to speak, he prompted, "'I believe, my friend, that such a bald statement requires some elaboration. You have us all on tenterhooks here, and simply cannot leave it at this. You must continue.' Finn was confused by his friend's sudden interest in a horse they'd always seemed to despise, never realizing they were hoping to learn something about him through what he revealed. But he could see they wanted more and was determined not to disappoint them. He licked his lips nervously, fought past his natural reluctance to speak, and continued. "'It was nigh on 3 years ago now,' he said softly, staring into the distance as he spoke. Twilight was settling over the land, muting the fiery reds, purples, and oranges that had burst across the sky at sunset to softer roses, violets, and golds, and siphoning the uncomfortable heat of day from the air. High above, the slender crescent moon could just be seen, with a growing array of stars punctuating the darkening sky. I still bounty hunting then, and tracked a feller I after down into Mexico. He gave a slight grim smile. Texas law couldn't follow him there, but I could. Chris smiled slightly. He'd seen Tanner on the hunt often enough to know how dogged the man was once he hit the trail. Boundaries and borders meant nothing to Van Tanner when he had scented his prey. He was a real bad hombre, Ben went on, his slow, soft drawl holding his friends mesmerized. Black Jack Harrigan. You name it, he done it, and most of it more than once. Reward on him was $500, dead or alive, he laughed. Ironic, ain't it? When his friends only shook their heads, seeming not to share his amusement at the grim joke, he shrugged and continued. Naturally, he didn't want to be took in, because he knew he was going to hang. So when I caught him, I had to kill him, he nodded firmly. Reckon it was best that-a-way. Hell, he had a noose waiting in so many towns, they'd have likely never sorted out who had first claim. So I done them all a favor. Sides, he frowned, and his eyes narrowed. The bastard killed my horse. Reckon he deserved to die for that alone. I took his, but it weren't nowhere near as good as mine. Damn, I hated losing that horse. He took another sip of coffee, gathered his thoughts, and went on. Anyways, I hauled his sorry carcass to the nearest border town, turned him over to the sorry bastard what called himself the sheriff, and got my money. Now you gotta remember... His gaze sought out J.D., who'd leaned forward expectantly. Them border towns is wild places. There's as much Mexican as American. Ain't much of neither law in 'em. Sheriff usually makes his real money looking the other way. But Lord knows them federales ain't always on the up and up. He winked at J.D. Imagine a whole string of towns just like Purgatorio, and you got South Texas. Geez, the boy breathed in wonder. Sounded like he'd have plenty to do when he joined the Texas Rangers. Anyways, Vin narrowed his eyes and frowned in thought. Along about the second day I was there, these fellers, Mexican banditos, I reckon, come thundering into town with a whole string of horses. Some stolen, I reckon, but others just caught for breaking and selling. And they started breaking them right there. His eyes and voice turned cold, and his face set hard in the firelight. But their ways weren't none I'd ever use on any animal. And they ruined as many horses as they broke. They was out to do it quick, and they didn't spare them poor animals no pity. It's all I could do not to shoot 'em. Chris scowled and let out a low hiss. He had an idea what Vin had seen. Had seen such cruel methods used himself, and had felt his own rage rise. He could well imagine how Tanner, who had a deep affinity for the spirits of all living creatures, must have felt in that town. Then Vin's head lifted, and his eyes flashed. But there was one horse they couldn't break, no matter how they tried, he said firmly, proudly, remembering the splendid sight. He fought him with all he had, took him on every one, and laid him low. They'd got him too late, you see. He'd been living wild and free too long to let any of them bastards beat him. But they tried. He spat through clenched teeth. Lord God, how they tried. Used their ropes and spurs and even whips. Had his mouth bleeding from the bits they used and tied his legs so he'd damn near break 'em if he moved wrong. But they couldn't break him. Horror and outrage filled the men as they listened to Tanner's soft, shaking voice, as they envisioned the cruelty he'd witnessed. And slowly they came to understand a bit more about the horse most of them routinely cursed. "It got to be a sport for him," Ben said, his low, hoarse voice dripping with venomous hatred. "I offered to buy him, but they wouldn't let him go till they'd had a crack at him. Even tried to steal him away one night, but they had too many guards. They was making money, you see," he said bitterly. "They was taking bets on whether they'd break him or kill him first." "Sweet Jesus," Ezra whispered, blanching and feeling sick. Throughout his life, he'd wagered on most anything one could imagine, and even some things one could not. But never had he sunk so low as to wager on anything as barbaric as the potential maiming or killing of an animal. Blood sport simply was not in his nature. "I reckon near everybody in town had a try at him," Ben went on, his soul aching at the memory of the exhausted, bloody, but unbeaten horse. "Even when they yelled at him, it drew a crowd." "Ah, shit," Buck breathed, bowing his head and closing his eyes. He remembered all the threats he routinely flung at Peso, never intending any of them, and suddenly wondered how many of them the horse had actually experienced. "I've seen his scars," J.D. said softly, sadly, hugging his knees to his chest and staring into the fire. "I wondered how he got 'em. I knew you'd never do those things," he said, looking at Ben. "But I've always wondered who could be low enough to do that kind of harm to a horse." "You don't want to know, kid," Ben sighed. "A man who'd do that to a horse would do it to another man. To anybody or anything. Just to prove he can. Man like that." He shook his head. "Ain't no man at all." "What happened?" Chris asked softly. Again, a grim smile curved about Ben's mouth, and his eyes flashed in the firelight. "He killed one of them," he said with a savage satisfaction. "Flung the bastard off his back and stomped him, and they were going to shoot him for it." Josiah eyed Ben steadily. "I'm assuming you managed to persuade him otherwise, brother?" Ben shrugged. "Reckon so." Chris arched a brow and gave a slight smile, familiar with a few of his friend's methods of persuasion. "Showed him the Tanner charm, did you?" "Shot one feller's fucking hand off," Ben spat, "and shot another in the knee." He lifted his chin and glared belligerently at his friends, daring them to disapprove. "Then I dropped a peso in the dirt, grabbed that horse by the reins, and got the hell out of town." He gave a fierce nod. "I didn't steal him, though. I bought him fair and square." Josiah chuckled appreciatively, and I'll guess no one dared debate that point. "Well," Ben said with a frown, "I had to shoot two more of them. But that's only because they was trying to shoot me," he shrugged. "They missed. I didn't. The rest of them fellers left me alone after that." "I bet they did," Chris said with a smirk. Imagine the spectacle of a band of horse-killing banditos subdued by the slender, outraged young man who spoke more eloquently with a gun than he ever would with words. "Nice to see you've always had a way with folks." "So what'd you do then?" J.D. asked, wanting to know more. Ben shrugged. "Done what I always do when I get sick of folks." "Headed up into the hills," Buck supplied knowingly. "Just you and your one peso horse." "Hell no," Ben countered. At Buck's questioning look, he grinned. "It was me, my one peso horse, and the horse I took from Harrigan. You don't think I walked out of that town, do you?" "Couldn't have been easy," J.D. mused, thinking of the cruelly mistreated horse. "I mean, he must have hated people after that." Vin nodded slightly, his eyes sad. "Still ain't just real fond of him. Reckon we always had that in common. Ain't neither of us ever met too many we could trust." He swept his gaze over his friends. "I know y'all don't like him, but you gotta understand. He was living wild and free till them bastards caught him. And then for 3 days, all he had from him was pain. He ain't got much reason not to hate folks." "There's you," J.D. put in quietly, resting an admiring gaze at his friend. "You helped him when nobody else would." Vin shrugged and stared down at his hands, frowning. "Reckon I knew how he felt," he said softly. "I've had folks try to break me a time or two." He shook his head as if to clear away that thought, then said, "But he didn't know I was trying to help him, so he fought me at first. I had to blindfold him just to treat his hurts. After a while, though, I reckon he saw I wasn't going to hurt him, and he let me tend him without the blindfold. I went real slow and easy with him, just let him get used to my touch, my voice, my scent. Hell, I even slept near him, just so he'd get used to having me around. We wintered up in the West Texas mountains, just me and them two horses. But when we come down again, I tell you," he nodded firmly, and a fierce pride shone in his eyes. "Me and that one peso horse could damn near read each other's minds, and we knew if we couldn't count on nobody else, we could count on each other. I sold Harrigan's horse, and it's been me and Peso ever since." "Well," Ezra murmured, "that grim tale certainly explains quite a bit." He grimaced deeply and shook his head. "I never thought I'd say this, yet I can't help but feel sympathy for, God help me, poor Peso. And now," anger crept into his voice as he recalled why they were here, "he has fallen once again into the hands of malefactors who cannot possibly have his best interests at heart." "I'm going to get him back," Vin said softly and grimly. "We're all going to get him back," Chris assured his friend. "I've never had any use for a thief, and I've got even less for a horse thief." He locked gazes with Vin, and a vow was made between them. "We'll get to Cutter's Pass tomorrow, pick up their trail from there and find him, and we'll get back your one peso horse." He smiled thinly. "And if you behave yourself and do what Nathan tells you, I'll let you shoot however many of them you want, wherever you want." Vin lifted his chin and scowled at the gunman. "And if I don't behave?" Chris's grin widened. "Then I'll make you stand still and listen while Ezra, Josiah, and J.D. talk him to death." Roy Tarber's mind was working. Night had fallen, and his men had safely reached Verde Canyon with the herd, and still there was absolutely no sign of those goddamn regulators from Four Corners. Larrabee and his men had never even made it to Cutter's Pass. He lay in his bedroll and stared up at the stars, thinking. True, Jake and his men had never made it back either, which meant they were likely dead, but it was also looking like they'd taken care of Larrabee's bunch as well, which left a whole new area of opportunity to open to any man with brains and guts enough to take it. And Roy Tarber had always had plenty of both. Nope, things weren't so bad after all. Mexico and Miguel Santiago could wait. The James Ranch wasn't the only spread in the area rich with stock. This territory was just ripe for the plucking. After all, who was going to stop him? Ignoring the men riding night guard and the other horses about him, Peso lowered his head and nibbled half-heartedly at the grass between his feet. He'd finally been allowed to graze, for the first time since he'd been taken from the livery. Still being Peso, he wasn't content with such favors. He wasn't where he wanted to be, and it simply was not in his nature to stay where he didn't want to be. Despite his apparent docility, his instincts were sharp, his senses were alert, and his troublesome mind was working, as were his old habits. Not wanting this grass, he sidled away to another patch, lowered his head, and nibbled. Still not happy, he spotted another patch and moved toward it. Each new patch of grass took him a bit further from the guards, a bit nearer the edge of the herd, a bit closer to the break in the canyon wall through which he knew freedom lay. He was a mountain horse at heart, born and raised in the high country, and every instinct in him was urging him back to the hills that had always been home. So, coyote smart, he doggedly grazed his way out of the herd toward the break, careful to do nothing that would attract the attention of the predators who watched the herd. And likely it would have worked, had some of the horses about him not chosen to follow him. He had characteristically spent most of his time among them trying to establish his dominance, loosing his foul temper on whatever poor animal had the bad fortune to wander too close to him. Yet even so, horse nature being what it was, some of the same animals whose lives he had been making miserable attached themselves to him as his followers, and stuck with him as he drew away from the herd. One horse sneaking off might not have attracted the notice of the night riders, A few horses scattered here and there throughout the canyon probably wouldn't have drawn their attention. But when they looked over and saw 10 horses getting further and further away, the men sprang immediately into action. "God damn it," Milt shouted, rousing his compadres. "That son of a bitch in black is leading them off. Get him." Peso heard the commotion and knew it meant trouble. Forgetting stealth, he threw up his head and tail and raced for the break in the wall. But the gash in his foreleg had gone too long unattended. He'd had too little feed, and pain, infection, and hunger overcame even his powerful desperation. He could manage nothing like the speed he needed, could not outrun the lasso sailing toward him. Once a Texas cowhand, Milt did not aim at the horse's head, but his forelegs. When the loop encircled both legs, he immediately jerked the rope tight, taking fast dallies about his saddle horn and sneering in vicious anticipation. "Gotcha, you devil." And then it happened. Peso hit the end of the rope, still running, and was thrown ass over tea kettle to the ground, landing hard. When he was down, another of the riders slid hurriedly to the ground, raced over to the fallen horse, and tied three of his legs together, rendering him unable to rise. "We'll just leave you there for a while, you son of a bitch," Milt snarled at the helpless horse. "Let you think about things for a while." He pulled in and coiled his rope, shaking his head in disgust. "Can't imagine what the hell Lem and Frank were thinking when they took you," he spat. "But you keep this up and I'll put a bullet between your eyes." The seven were awake at dawn and breakfasted on the remains of last night's supper. Even Ezra managed to roll out of his blankets and pull himself to something resembling wakefulness, though he seemed to have lost the power of speech, and stared at the cup of coffee Josiah pressed into his hands as if it were totally alien to him. "Drink," Sanchez instructed with a sympathetic smile, wondering if the gambler had any idea where he was or how he'd gotten here. And knowing they'd all best enjoy the uncharacteristic silence while it lasted. When everyone had eaten, Nathan again sent four of them away so he could apply the liniment once more to Vin's battered body. He allowed Chris to stay, ostensibly to make sure Vin behaved, but more truly because he knew the tracker would feel more at ease with the man nearby. He doubted he'd ever really understand how two men so different in nature, so independent and so inherently solitary, had come to rely on each other so deeply and so instinctively, but he knew he didn't have to. All he really had to do, like everyone else, was simply accept it and be grateful for it. Some things, after all, were never meant to be understood. Nathan's ministrations were as painful as they'd been yesterday, but Vin knew they were necessary. The bruised muscles stiffened up overnight, and if he had any hope of riding, hell of moving today, he had to let Nathan's hands and the liniment work. So he accepted and tolerated the pain with a stoic forbearance, determined to endure whatever he had to for the sake of getting back his stolen horse and getting back at the bastards who'd stolen him. Dawes roused the men as soon as the sun appeared over the canyon walls with the idea of starting at once for Mexico. He knew there were plenty of horses elsewhere, plenty of other places and ways to make money, but only if he managed to avoid hanging or getting shot. So with the fear of Larrabee and his men having been firmly and deeply planted in him by Roy Tarber, he was stunned and not a little anxious when Tarber told him to relax, that they would not be leaving just yet. Dawes listened in shock as his boss said they needed more horses to take to Santiago, that this area would make them all rich. All the time he listened, his mind screamed that being rich didn't mean shit if he was too dead to enjoy it. Tarber ignored his second-in-command's concerns and overrode his protests, refusing as ever to credit any thought that didn't spring from his own brain. If Larrabee and his men were coming, he reasoned, they would have been here by now. Clearly Jake and the boys had taken them out of the picture, and with no other real law in these parts, the pickings were just too good to pass up. They were staying put until he decided otherwise. "And just to keep the boys from getting too restless," he added with a leering grin, "we'll have us some entertainment. I've decided to offer a bonus to any man that could break that half-wild devil horse Lem and Hank took from the tracker." Dawes eyed his boss with a combination of disbelief and disgust. Larrabee and his bunch were after him, and Roy wanted them all to play bronc busters. Jesus, God in the morning. Lem and Hank, who had overheard the entire conversation, watched as Dawes stalked away, muttering and shaking his head. They exchanged confused glances, then walked away as well. Their steps took them near the blaze-faced gelding, and they stopped and stared at their prize. He was hobbled and tied far from the herd, far from any grazing. None of his various gashes, including new ones sustained last night from the merciless ropes, had been tended, and the ones on his foreleg and nose had started to fester. Yet for all his ragged, worn-down, beaten-up appearance, he still eyed them with an angry, threatening defiance, seemed not to understand at all that he was a captive, or to care that he was about to become sport for a bunch of hard men, lured by the promise of gold, to do their worst, to break that unyielding spirit. And as those fierce, dark eyes marked them, challenged them, Lem and Hank suddenly felt themselves touched by the same cold dread that had gripped Dawes. "You know, don't you?" Hank asked the horse. Certain the animal understood every word he was saying. "You know they're coming, and that Roy's sealing all our death warrants by keeping us here, and you're just going to keep us all distracted till they get here." "Roy's a fool," Lem breathed bitterly. "A fool for thinking them seven ain't coming. A fool for thinking any of us can break this horse. And a fool for thinking we're all going to be rich when all we're going to be is dead. Well, hell," he spat, turning away from the black and staring up at Hank. "I ain't going to be dead. Not for the likes of Roy." Hank blinked and frowned in confusion. "What are you going to do?" Lem scowled. "I'm going to get my horse, and I'm going to get my ass across the border, and I ain't coming back. Gold ain't no good if you're too dead to spend it." He nodded firmly. "I got enough already. I'm going to get myself a cantina and a senorita whilst I'm alive enough to enjoy 'em. And if you're smart, you'll come with me." "What about him?" he asked softly, gesturing toward the gelding. Lem sighed sharply and shook his head in exasperation, setting clenched fists on his hips. "Face it, Hank, he ain't yours, and he ain't ever going to be yours. That horse'll kill you first chance he gets and hightail it back to that goddamn tracker. And shit, as far as I'm concerned, Tanner's welcome to him." "He's a fine animal," Hank murmured longingly. "Purty, too. Real smart, real spirited." He swallowed hard and licked his lip, pondering his own words. "And I reckon if I had me a horse like that, I'd be pissed as hell at somebody done stole him. Pissed enough to kill whoever done it if I caught him." "Well?" Lem prompted patiently. Hank sighed and shook his head mournfully. "Horse like this'n might be worth killing for, but he sure as hell ain't worth dying for." He grinned suddenly down at Lem. "Reckon you could use a partner in your cantina?" Lem thought a moment, then nodded. "Reckon I could, but," he warned, "you'll have to get your own senorita." Hank's grin widened. "Reckon there's enough down there to go around." He stepped forward to give the gelding one last pat, and immediately jumped back to avoid the wicked teeth that snapped at him. "Nope," he sighed. "On second thought, I ain't going to miss you at all. Come on, Lem, he urged. "Let's get out of here. I think I hear Mexico calling." They walked away without ever looking back, tacking their horses as the camp stirred to life about them, then mounting quietly. Looking for all the world as if they were doing no more than going out to check the herd, Lem Howard and Hank Fine made their break from Roy Tarber and from his inevitable fate. Only Dawes recognized their leaving for what it was, and he silently wished them well. "One more thing, Hank," Lem warned softly as they left Tarber's gang behind. "You ever ask me to help you steal another goddamn horse, and I'll put a bullet between your eyes."